lights out, we're underway. It's Motorsport Republica podcast.
G'day, Pete. I'm Mark from Motorsport Republica. Just thought I'd get you on here, mate, for the guys, and just tell us a bit about yourself and the history and basically what's going on this weekend. So everyone that doesn't know, this is Peter Bond. Many years experience in the paddock and all sorts of paddocks. If I get this right, Superbikes, Moto2, MotoGP. Sure I've left a few out.
Oh, Mark, that's a long time ago. I keep it short, but yeah, it's been a couple of years. There were always Aussie riders in my life. So
give us a brief on your history in motorsport.
I started in 2000 working at Tenkate Honda in the Supersport, and then we went to Superbike as well. From there on, I did 1 year the AMA Championship for Factory Ducati Superbike. Then it was 3 years with Yamaha Factory. Then it was a lot of years in Moto2, Moto3, Moto2, Moto3, until finally in 17 I had enough of going to a plane every week. I'm not the youngest anymore. Now, for many years, I'm like a 2D data recording expert. That's a big part of my living, like selling it and teaching people how to use it up to all levels, not MotoGP level, I'm very honest in that. And besides that, I write technical articles for several magazines over the world. I have a podcast we've made actually as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that. Oxybomb MotoGP podcast with the guys. They get on every week after every race and talk the talk, and Peter gives of all the technical stuff. It's quite fascinating, the stuff he dives into on the pod, as well as they do the chit-chat about the race and talk about all sorts of things. So you can catch that at Oxybomb. MotoGP podcast. So Peter, just back to your working days there. So this MotoGP at the moment, from when you were in it to what it is now, how do you see the big differences with what's going on with all this technological?
Yeah, okay. First of all, I was in many classes except MotoGP itself.
Sorry, I meant the class.
I actually deliberately avoided that. Didn't really went for probably there's a place there, because I know I'm like a simple guy, and I consider myself like a basic guy that has its value more in Moto2, Moto3, probably Superbike as well, because I know quite something about everything. So if I'm in a team, we don't go really wrong, but at the same time, don't give me like a completely new analysis software of something like, I better have an expert for that. I have the overview, and in MotoGP, there is either the crew chief, he's what I'm describing, but then another level, or there is extreme experts that have only one job and only one thing and do have to go very deep in that. I don't want to do that. So the other thing is 22 times in a year. Come on, But I do a little bit of crew chief and data recording still. I was supposed to do last year for BMW the Asian Superbike Championship for BMW, and I love the whole package, but after the first round in Motegi, the team went bankrupt.
So they're trying to come back again.
So I might be here in Asia again this year, because that's only six or seven rounds. Beautiful. In sunny culture, I love it.
And so with the technology now in MotoGP overall, like how have you find it just from the outside looking in, from when back when you were working in Moto2 and Superbikes and stuff? It's like an arms race. That's what I believe it's turned into with just the just keep coming with all new devices. And how have you seen that progress and where it's at?
It's a bit double in my head, because I love seeing new things that really work. And some of the new things that we see are just somebody had to come up at some point because the technology became available. When it's like, look at the past, when carbon fiber became available. I mean, that's not rocket science. There's new materials or new electronics, especially coming available, we start to use it. But some of the new things that are on the bike, why didn't we think of that before? So I love that, but I love racing more. And Tona has to be very, very careful how to steer the MotoGP ship. If you let the factories loose, you end up with extreme prototypes that go way too fast for every track. Yes, you don't have races anymore and are boring to watch. It's basically robot wash. So they need to be very careful. And I'm a bit disappointed that it took them so long to say we have a new set of rules going into 2027. Just a little bit smaller engine, that's not a big thing. Bit on the aero, but the biggest problem they solved then is the ride height devices. That we had to get rid of immediately. Should have got rid of it last year. I mean, really, it's one of these examples that, why didn't I think of that before? Because it's amazing what it brings. And then you say, okay, good enough, GG Ducati, you had it 2 years, and now maybe let's all get rid of it. But we still with it, and I go in pit lane, like every hour and I see still new updates and very expensive parts on the fucking ride-out devices for the last 2 years. Should have banned it earlier. I hate it. I hate them.
Agree. And so do you think they haven't gone far enough with the 2027 rules?
No.
So what else do you think? What's off the top of your head? What else would you get rid of straight up?
Tire grip. Maybe sounds weird, but they have everything in control except Michelin or when Pirelli maybe comes. And the tire manufacturer, in the end of the day, the tire is the most important thing on any bike. Yes. Tires is everything.
Well, we've seen last year's rear tire, it just became...
All these guys here in the pit boxes are doing is trying to extract the best out of each tire, and they have to go in some extreme... Ducati found that out very, very well. They say, okay, Michelin has an unbelievable rear tire and a not-so-unbelievable front tire. We changed the whole bike.
Yeah, the whole Ducati,
already years ago, they found that...
That's why they got the advantage.
And the Ducatis are completely rear-wheel-based. So everything, all the lap time, comes from the rear, in accelerating and in stopping. And mid-corner speed, that's your problem. We pay you the bucks to do that. Then you get... And they win. And then there is the Yamaha, the Honda, especially the Yamaha, which is still like a really old school bike. You know, all the riders that jump on the Yamaha say, ah, I'm beautiful, I have fun, suddenly I feel the front. Yeah, but your lap time is not coming.
I mean, that's
a dangerous direction. So tires are the most thing. Simply said, smaller tires.
Okay.
Smaller tires, would be a big step.
Okay, okay. It decreases the grip as well. That's another area.
Less grip, less edge grip, because the way they do 60 degree lean angle and then can really accelerate and they put it up a little bit. And what not many people know is that the acceleration of a MotoGP bike, when we think about acceleration, means like accelerating. But the fastest acceleration, like the highest G forces, is not upright. Is when you bank.
When
they exit second gear corners and they pick it up to 50, 45 degrees, then there is, because the suspension is pressed in by the centrifugal forces, that means there's a lot of load on the tire, and then they open a lot and the bike fires out. And as soon as it gets upright, it's all wheelie, wheelie, and wheelie control, and that's it, you can't do anything more. Yeah. And these accelerations are huge.
Too much.
We have to slow down that a little bit by just bringing narrower tires. Because if you give or bring a spec tire that everybody has to use that keeps us in. You remember last year, beginning last year, Michelin brings suddenly here, exactly here, a new rear tire that gave a shit amount of lap time faster, but it also make everybody except Ducati chatter around the world, as Jack Miller.
It
ruins his career.
Yes.
And he was on a bike manufactured that didn't solve that problem quickly enough. Ducati didn't have a problem at all. Oh, come on. I mean, in the rules, they're looking for 2027 to probably go 1.5, maximum 2 seconds slower. If Michelin brings next another tire, we find another second. So what are you going to do?
Some of those races last year, they were improving by 20 seconds, 15 seconds. And
that
was all on the tire. Everyone was saying, oh, look how far.
It's the tire.
I don't believe
it's only the
technology.
The technology is not 1.5 a second or a second in a year. Mm. Not at all. That's the tire. Everything improves. But basically what you're doing is understand your tire quicker than everybody else. And Ducati is very, very good at that. They're very, very good at many things. They can go on a holiday for 2 years and still win 2 championships. And then everybody is up.
Just on that, and from what you've seen so far this weekend, this week at the test, is Ducati's always the upper hand, clear again. Is anybody really going to bridge that gap this year, do you think?
No, not this year. Not this year. I'm a bit disappointed and worried for KTM and Aprilia, what we've seen so far. Okay, what we've seen so far. This is halfway the third day. I know they will say, we were just testing part, but you know how riders are. If they go out and they push for 80%, that means that they are in the safe, they are in their comfort zone, but they know where they should be in the ranking. If they come back to the box, they pushed 80%, they are in P5, they say, wow, everything's cool. But if they're in P22 and they're missing 2 seconds, they say, well, if I do the last 20%, that's not going to be enough.
That's right.
So they say we are testing, but at the same time, if you look lab, if they're all too slow, they're in trouble. Right. And so I don't see the biggest surprise so far is definitely Yamaha.
Yes, it seems that way.
And the bike looks still the same, but it has lots of small changes. They have an incredible, and all the new riders, Jack, suddenly have a front end that works, and the lap time's not bad. Yeah. So, but Ducati still is there. What Ducati is doing here, the Lenovo factory team, it's easy to fuck up when you lead a lot, because you think everything that works. So they are having to choose a new engine. And actually, like you said, the engine freeze. Actually, here in this test, all the manufacturers must choose their engine for this year and next year.
Because you get it wrong, they're fine.
After this, next week we are in Buriram, but that's too late to say, if this is the engine, then I have enough of them.
Yeah,
so here they choose it. So Ducati spends now 2.5 days on last year's bike with just a new engine, and they are not convinced. That's the funny thing.
Well, the talk so far...
They're not so clear. It's a better engine.
They want to put the engine in last year's chassis.
Yeah, that's what they do here.
That's what it's looking at the moment. 24.5 is what the bike's being dubbed. Yeah. meaning the 24 and a half, meaning it's last year's with a bit of this year. Instead of calling it the 25, the joke I heard this morning was to call it the 24 and a half.
Yeah, yeah. What they did, and I found that very clever, we don't change anything on last year's bike because that's an unbelievable good bike. We only put the new engine in it, and then everything we don't like must come from the engine. Mm. And there are things they don't like from the engine. For example, the engine brake, it's coming from the electronics when you shift down, is not nice control. So they're starting to feel loose confidence during the straight braking phase, which is a huge thing. So it might have more power and be more top speed that doesn't cancel out. So don't be surprised if now they are rolling out the real 25 bike with last year's engine and say, that's the package.
Oh, freeze it,
that's
engine.
It. I will not be surprised if they end up doing that. Because if they choose the wrong engine, they have it for 2 years. Eh?
Yeah,
that's here.
Can't afford that. Yeah.
The way Pekka Meijer yesterday spoke with us, we are the scum, the media, they say, he suggested, like, I can't imagine living with last year's engine. So you hear it here first.
And I heard you recently, maybe 18 months ago, talk about how you couldn't understand why the Ducati had the mass dampener and the others hadn't used this yet. And here we are at this test, KTM and Honda have turned up with a mass dampener. Can you explain just what difference that would make to a bike, or the fact that, is it just by choice that they didn't want to have it, or... I don't want to say choice, the technology wasn't right for those bikes, because how is it Ducati... You know, everyone was sort of pointing to maybe there was this mass dampener that was some sort of part of their package that was working the best, but... Now these other two manufacturers have turned up with this mass dampener.
I'm not even sure if there's mass dampers in KTM and Aprilia.
Because the
mass damper is simple explanation of the mass damper is, it is like a mechanism in the rear of the seat, which is supposed to be when the bike banks over a lot. I mean, when the bike's upright, you have your own shock and your damper system. You know what's happening. When you bank over 45 to 60 degree, like this, every bump in the track doesn't go into the suspension, it goes in the side of the chassis. So you want to swing arm the chassis to bend. But when there is a lot of little ripples in the corner, the rear wheel is already on the edge of the tire, will start to move, lose contact. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have a system in the back of your seat quite high, that is like, basically it is a weight between two springs. It's held between two springs. So it always works against the movement. If the bike quickly comes up, that weight says, no, I don't want to. And then it says, no, I want back. And so if you tune the spring force and the mass from that very cleverly with the frequencies that you think are happening, then you solve that solution. But then the next corner, there can be another frequency. Ducati love small gains and do everything for it.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Because a Ducati is a really complicated motorbike. I have friends in teams that were on Ducatis last year, now it's in Yamaha. Oh, that's a normal motorbike. Suddenly a normal motorbike. The Ducati was like so complicated.
Yeah, but this same degree.
But that same mass damper is such very difficult thing. It's heavy, difficult to make it really work everywhere. And Ducati is very far there. So that's one end of the spectrum. That's how it's supposed to work.
One portion of it,
yeah. I know that Honda and others have played with it. But they also know that they backpedaled. They said, that doesn't bring enough. There's something we don't understand, or it's really not worth it. It's an extra 1.5 kilo, a lot of electronics, because some of them are actively coming from electronic control. The reason everybody is now speaks suddenly again about mass dampers in KTM and everywhere is because we see a lot of new seat units, and it's supposed to be in the seat unit.
Right,
The reason I'm saying I'm not so sure there is a mass damper in it, because coming back to the ride height devices, you want the bikes at the start as really low as possible. And if you drop the rear out of the corner, you want it to be really low, because the lower it is, the effectiver it is. Now, to get really low, you need a lot of space on top of your wheel. Look at the bike when it's on the stands. Mm-hmm. There's like a motocross bike.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you have already your, 70 millimeters of wheel travel. Yeah, and then if you drop it also another 4 or 5 centimeters, that's a lot, and you have to have that space. Sometimes they're just repackaging things. Look at the KTM from last year. It had on top of on the end, under the seat, there was one exhaust under the seat, one beside it. Now they have two of them on the side. And for that, they make a new seat unit. But maybe only for that. Maybe it was just repackaging. Or they found a way to make the damper work. But then they need to do a lot more homework. Because here, it doesn't show so far. It doesn't show. This is just my... All of these actually are my opinions. Eh?
That's why you're here, mate.
And yeah, so thank
of
you.
The rookies, this test, any rookies that surprised you? Like Aldeguer came in with a bad reputation about the way he finished the back end of his Moto2 season. He seems to have done very good here.
Fermin Aldeguer is a huge surprise.
Yes.
Ayagura does everything correct, but Ayagura,
Japanese.
with all respect, because don't get me wrong, all these guys are really, really, really good. But if you have to put them in an order, I is not normally there in the like the seriously gifted people that have a huge natural talent. I is not there, but I is clever and works very hard. And he did a lot of all the good work in the shakedown test. He keeps doing the good work, doesn't crash too much, extract the best out of himself in this new Aprilia. It's good. Mm. It's actually faster than I was expecting to be.
Yes.
So that package is not bad, and he's clever in learning. But Fermin Aldeguer is another thing. He wasn't winning last year's World Championship Moto2, but he's still really young. He's 19 years old. Yes. He had already, for 19 years old, he has a lot of experience. He's quite bright. But he's also very lucky, because now to jump on a 24 Ducati is the best package. You have no questions. Mm. They just play a little bit with the setup, and everything that happens when you're on a 24 Ducati, if it goes wrong, it must be me. So you dig harder in yourself. Mm. You look harder how to make the bike work. Whether if you're like Bezzecchi now, going to a new manufacturer and suddenly have to lead the development because Jorge Martin crashed the balls out in the first hour, then suddenly you need to make a lot of decisions, and then if a bike doesn't do that what you wanted in a corner, you start easily say, well, it must be the bike, go back to the box and say, well, it doesn't work in the corner. But if you're on a 24 Ducati, there's no point in going back to the box and saying make the bike better, because that bike is huge. It's an amazing bike. It's the best Ducati ever. So everybody on a 24 this year is really, really happy, but will not have updates over the year. But it's a really good package to start with, and Fermin immediately picks it up, learns it. But between you and me, the Ducati is not just simply the best, it's also the easiest. Because it has an automatic system when you decide you want the rear to drop. On the Honda, where Chantra the rookie is, on the Aprilia, where Ayagura is, you have to find that moment yourself. And they really need a lot of time to find that moment. Some corners is really early, but too early, you go on the curbs. And too late, you lose the acceleration. With Ducati, that's all automatic. Not electronically, mechanically automatic. Mm-hmm. So when you're a rookie, the 24 Ducati is a gift. But then, even considering all these things, Fermin Aldeguer does a really good job.
Yes, yeah, so it's been challenging for really 3-4 days. You know?
Yeah.
And just speaking of Aprilia, obviously it's very disappointing with Martin having this accident on the first morning. And that sort of puts him behind the eight ball, doesn't it? I mean, do you think he'll be ready for the first race?
No, it doesn't seem so.
Been talking.
This cost him almost half a season.
Really?
It's the worst moment of the whole year. Yes. To do what he did. And I said what he did because I blame him a little bit on it. I know riders can crash, but come on.
So he's going too hot there?
He's leading the development. He's supposed to start leading the development of the Aprilia. Aprilia brings, honestly, 12 completely different bikes here.
Yes, we spoke about this
for him
recently.
To test.
Variations, yes.
And the situation here is we have 3 days of testing. That's a lot of riding. So you can take your time, because the track condition is constant over the whole day. The early in the morning is the best, but it's good for testing.
Wind,
You know you have a lot of work to do, and you know there are two types of rear tires. One that will not work at all, because they know the tire. I don't know why Michelin brings it. The other one works very well, but you don't have a lot of them. What does he do who goes out early in the morning on a really cold track? It has never been as cold as then, with a hard rear tire. He lost it immediately. He lost it in turn one. He goes back to the box, go out again, and only in his third outing, I mean, an outing is 2-3 laps, eh? It's maybe two flying laps. In his third outing, he goes out and he high sides into turn two over the engine brake, over going into turn two, too much engine brake, the rear locks and sends him over. If I was his team manager, I mean, on publicity, they support him. They say, no, it must be the tire's fault and so on. But if I was his crew chief, I would say, come on, guy. You've just been too eager. Take your time. We have 3 days. Wait. I mean, other crew chiefs I spoke to, well, we don't even go out with a tire. Because there's nothing to learn. That tire is so slow. You learn nothing. You only get confused. We wait until the conditions are good for the soft tire, then we have enough. Not him. With all his experience, he brings his crew. There's a lot of experience. But in the end, if a rider is that keen to go, that eager, he went out, and even one small crash was not the warning he needed. And the other one was a biggie. I'm so sorry for Jorge Martin in Aprilia because I love that bike.
Yes, you've been a fan of that bike for a long time. But yeah, I know, I've listened to you over the last couple of years and you've always talked that bike up. Saying that you need better riders, and this was the time they had the better rider. Top level rider like Martin, and it's all just gone pear-shaped after the
Now they need to choose the engine, and he's not there. That's the engine for 2 years. They have to choose many parts, so he is having surgery and come back and has to accept, I think, that the first half of the season is to develop, not even look at the points. But man,
and with that choosing the engine, like, they've only got one rider that's continued over that was on the bike last year, because the other three are all new. So this is going to make this decision even more so. I mean, Salvadori can probably have some input as
well. Yeah, Salvadori has. He does a really good job at Aprilia. Yeah. He's obviously too slow, but he does. He knows. I'm not even trying to be faster, because when you give him a soft tire, he improves a second, which is still 1.5 away from the best. He does a lot of good work, but at some point, the bike is completely ready to give it to the guys that push it really on the limit and see what happens then. If you give them the bike too early, they're fully confused. So Salvadori does all his work, and he's ready with his work. And then Jorge Martin needs to be on the bike, or Raúl Fernández, which is the other guy that I'm going to say more or less the same as about him as I said about Jorge Martin, but worse, because he did it 3 years in a row, coming to Sepang, crashing his balls out on the first morning.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really wanting to destroy his own career. That's very bad what he did, you know.
And so with the test next week, like, clearly Salvadori will have a more input, like I said earlier, with his engine choice.
Yeah.
They're going to have to listen to him a little bit on this, you know, because he's got the experience
Bob Bezzecchi is now on the bike. He had a shit year last year.
Forgiven the bike he was on.
Yeah, exactly. Because the year before, he was number three in the championship,
races,
rookie of the year.
Leading at one point.
And he did show last year that he could not adjust his riding style to a 1 year on the Ducati, which is a poor sign. Because if everything is correct, that's one thing, but you have to
People still talk him up, but the reality is, if he couldn't adapt to a bike that was the best bike the year before, and he's now on another bike again, this is another whole set of circumstances he has to learn, which puts him on the back foot even more so. So moving on to KTM, I mean, the lineup looks like a superstar, you know, lineup there with the four riders and the four names, but that bike there, like, it's always seems to be knocking on the door. Like, last year we saw it up there a little bit.
Almost there.
But, you know, with this rider lineup, I mean, okay, Costa's a superstar, he's the future of the sport and that, but surely these group of riders with the experience, apart from Costa, the other three have, can put this project and bring it up even more. So what's your thoughts on that, Peter?
Well, KTM's problem is KTM, not the riders.
Yeah, well,
and that started months ago. I mean, now for a couple of months, we all know the super crisis financially where KTM is in, but that means internally it was already known before. I'm pretty sure from my sources, no names, that already months ago in KTM, project was stopped or back in the fridge. Because.
Okay.
So what they bring here is not what they should have brought, all of them. And with Da Costa and Binder, they have a really good lineup. The other two is, I'm not so sure. But anyway, they were certainly on the market. so you got them. And it's Da Costa's pace so far that makes me a little bit worried. Like I said, if you're pushing 80% from your maximum, still just in your comfort zone, and your name is Da Costa on the latest KTM, even when you're testing pass, you should be a little bit closer. So yesterday, he went for a serious time attack. Did everything correct, but 0.6. I mean, that's not even Q2, eh?
Yeah.
If we come back.
Not.
So,
no,
and he.
And, you know, being as competitive as it is, that's going to be the difference, isn't it? Yeah. Q1, Q2, you're pushing shit uphill for the rest of the weekend.
That changes your whole
tire,
weekend.
Yeah. You know, for the Saturday morning and stuff.
Yeah. So. But it's a bit early to really say KTM's not here and to really say. I mean, Aprilia must be in problem because two good riders are in the hospital. Then I know they're in trouble. But it's still the last day of the first test, and if this afternoon now, if they go for a time attack, they go either for a time attack or a race simulation, or sometimes even both of them, and that's the moment you put your best chassis from the weekend, your best engine, your best ECU setting, you put everything together, and that's it. And then they have just a couple of days to think about it, and next week it's off in Buriram for the last test, and then it's racing.
Now, we haven't spoken about Honda, Peter. Like, Honda, Marini seems to make him good noise there. He's happy with what the parts they've brought here and stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, obviously, they tend to
be
on
Yamaha.
Yeah, well, he's talking about the way the bike's working a bit better, but it's all about the lap time. But, you know, they've been in a world of pain for a couple of years now. Any light at the end of the tunnel there, do you think, what's coming, what they've shown at this test? Or just still going backwards?
Is there any honour people watching, listening?
Just say how it is.
I'm afraid there is still no light in the end of the tunnel. And Honda's real, like I said, KTM's problem is KTM's financial situation, not where the wheels are or the issue. And Honda's problem, as far as I see it, has never been the technology. I mean, there's a lot of clever people at Honda. They can go rocket, go to the moon and land here and not there. They know. Yeah. But to make it all work together in a way that a modern MotoGP team works, they don't get it. No. They're still living in the past, like, we create a new bike, send it to Sepang, do a couple of setup things, and that's it. And maybe once in the year, if everything chatters too much, we bring a new Sassy. But now, if Gigi on the way to Italy has an ID, he calls from the plane, they start the printer in Bologna, and next week in Buriram, there is another fucking swing arm. And, you know, Honda will not have another swing arm in 1 or 2 weeks. That will take them months. Everybody has to agree and test it. Yeah. Okay, and they did everything good in Europe. They buy all the good people, all the good riders. Everybody that I know from Europe are the good people. But then whatever Europe wants has to be approved in Japan. And I think that still is not clear enough. And Yamaha went completely Europe. Well, Yamaha said, we put everything in Max Bartolini's hands. Max is every month in the plane. And they have everyday viewer meetings and so on to make the best of two cultures, of two worlds, of two different countries. That's why I rate Yamaha, give them a lot more. I think they will be quicker successful than Honda. Because in Honda, I still doubt if the strategy, the philosophy has changed enough really deep inside Honda. But, you know, it's not for... It must hurt. Honda is a very proud company for engines. You ever visit the Motegi Museum?
No, I haven't been.
You walk out of there, that's a huge museum from Honda. And when you walk out of there, you realize again one thing. It's all about the engine. They love their engine. They make all sorts of engines. They're so proud of engine. But now they're already the slowest. Yesterday there was a completely new engine, 1 km/h. That's Honda, eh? It's Honda and Ducati that pride themselves on engines, and Honda can't do it for... That must hurt. Can't understand it.
Yeah, just sad. Sad circumstances. I made a comment a couple of weeks ago. I was on one of the pods, and they said... I made the comment that Nakagami, part of his role is to communicate between Japan.
Yeah.
What is that? What the fuck is that shit? Like, what, mate?
We were shocked as a journalist when he said, my job is... To tell the engineers in Japan what's happening in Europe, like telephone or doesn't exist, like the fax is not even invented yet. I'm like, that's very painful what you're saying. And he was just like, try to be honest. And even the PR woman or man didn't understand how painful that actually is. But he puts it on the spot. That's how it is. The communication is really not there.
And of course, I have to speak about Marc Marquez now. He's in the factory team. I mean, you always call these riders special riders. You've mentioned him and Acosta and over the juniors and previous great champions. So have you seen this? Like, you know, this week he seems to take into a duck to water, you know, with this new bike and stuff. Yeah. But, you know, injuries aside, I mean, is he the old Mark? Probably not. But is he still good enough to beat the rest? I think so. But, you know.
Yeah, me too.
You think so too as well?
The most likely world champion for this year's MotoGP will be Marc Marquez. But he's vulnerable.
Of course.
Because he is over 30. You're not a young, talented rookie forever. He's now the oldest guy on the grid often or in the press conference.
Last year he was actually going for maturity, wasn't he? Yeah. He was actually not doing Marquez things.
No.
So it's like all these accidents have finally made him realise, you know what, I'm not Superman.
Yes.
Because that's what the thing about this guy. Every time he crashed, he'd run back to the pits and jump on the bike.
He had exactly the same crash as Jorge Martin, and he just walked away, and Martin is in the hospital.
Yeah,
and
well,
it looked the same.
It looked the same, actually.
He was a rubber. Last year was a year that I respected Mark maybe more than ever. And I've seen him up close a couple of... In 2011, when I was Stefan Bradl's crew chief, we were fighting Mark for the Moto2 World Championship.
That's right.
And the only reason we won it and not him is he crashed so much he couldn't even see straight. Actually, his last crash was here when it started to rain in one. I mean, he was seriously talented, but way too crazy at that moment. So we were just lucky there. But last year, he needed to learn to ride... in a very unnatural way.
Yes.
He came from Honda, from normal bikes, you know, with the beautiful feedback from the front. And he needed to adapt to a Ducati.
Which goes from the rear.
And as soon as you ride a Ducati with the rear up and sideways, you crash and you're slow. Man, over 30 and learning to ride unnaturally, because it must feel weird to do like that. It took him half a season, then he got it. Still makes mistakes every now and then.
I know the bike now. I'm like, that's a big mission.
Now he learned himself how to ride the Ducati. He's in the factory team. He knows how to fight for championships. Mm. Everybody's very worried for the atmosphere in the team between him and Pecco. We see. Pecco is confident, is serene, is calm. Knows he's like he is almost a Ducati himself. He's always been on the Dukes. Yeah. He can be confident. He will be there. And Marx, I just said I expect him to be world champion. When I said he's vulnerable, it's but you can't keep on crashing or walking away from it. No. He's over 30. He will start to break bones and be out of it as well. Yeah, because you lose a little bit that super reflex. Every year after 30.
Even though he's still like a cat.
Yeah. But when he was like 18, it was unbelievable what he could do, or 20, 25. But now, you don't have that anymore. Not that super, super edge. Mm. And you're more vulnerable. Let's see if how he handles it. But that still is the bike and the team to be in. It's between these two.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And look, just for the listeners out there, like a friend of the pod, Chris from Mullen, who the boys interviewed a couple of times. You worked with Chris. Can you just sort of tell us a few stories maybe about your time with Chris?
I had a lot of Aussies in my career, like Carl Mugritz and Brock Parks, Damien Cutlin. No, not Damien Cutlin, Damien was another guy. Anyway, whatever. Chris van Meulen. I worked with Chris 2 years. I was his data guy when he became world champion Supersport. And because he was promised a superbike if he became world champ, which we thought it was never going to happen. But he became world champ, so we need to buy a superbike for him.
Right.
Or make a superbike Honda. We only had a stock bike, so basically we went superbike racing with a stock bike.
Okay.
With a complicated front fork, which didn't really work. In the end, it was honestly just a stock bike. I think we finished fourth and fifth 2 years in the championship just because Chris is Chris.
Yeah.
Because Chris is... At that time, it was already a real pleasure working with Chris. But only later, when I had more years with Stefan Bradl, with Danny Kemp, but also years that we had not even 1 point in Moto2 or Moto3, I realized more how special Chris was, and also what his downside was. But he was, he's in my top 2 or 3 riders that can give very clear comment. When Chris went out, did a couple of laps, comes in, he could write a book. For him, everything happens in slow motion, and he can exactly explain what the bike did when he did that, and testing front tires, which is so that he had so much comment about everything. But Chris likes to stay in his comfort zone. Chris hates crashing. So he had a long and good career. He has balls because it's scary. You know, he was a master in the wet.
But basically he
did everything that he was quite sure that this is going to work. He had an amazing feeling and reflexes. Very clever on how to pick up stuff on the bike. But he's not the guy that got bonsai. Probably he's the guy that made the most accurate comments coming back, and also was completely calm with it. If we didn't solve it, then we just didn't solve it. You know, I make the best of it at Sunday.
It makes the team's job easier, doesn't it? The mechanics,
He was great for the atmosphere. There's no surprise he went straight to MotoGP and so on. And he had a good career in MotoGP. But I always was thinking, oh, come on, Chris, just a bit more, you know. But it's him.
Yeah.
It's him.
Mungo, we call it in Australia.
Yeah, okay, Mungo.
Mungo, maybe it's a little bit more.
Super good guy. Always happy. Every couple of years we run into each other. We know exactly what we had together. And he had a more amazing career after me, you know, in MotoGP. But that's also Chris. He's humble and normal. He will always remember and say hi. And yeah, it was always a pleasure to see him.
All right, look, I appreciate your time coming on here today. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for inviting me.
Look, and guys, get on, guys and girls, get on and start following Peter Bond. You'll find him on the socials. And he's also on the podcast, Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast. Thanks for your time today, mate.
No, thanks. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you, mate. Yeah. Take care. All good.
Bye, everyone.
All good.